Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I just want to say we have a nice little collection developing already of people's favorite YouTube videos on this fifth anniversary of YouTube. We have actual videos on the page on our website, so if you want to go see some of our staff's favorite YouTube videos ever and some others that are coming in, it's a nice little collection of videos already at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we want yours. We want you to add your favorite YouTube video ever with the URL if you can, but you don't have to, at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, because today is the fifth anniversary of YouTube, and then we'll talk about what's up there, play the audio from some, and talk about the larger impact of YouTube on our culture on Monday's show. Now, we all know that judging people based on stereotypes is unfair and ignorant, but compelling research shows that even just the possibility of being stereotyped can produce profound negative outcomes. Social psychologists call it a stereotype threat, or a fear of confirming negative cultural stereotypes, and can cause us to do poorly on tests, underperform on the ball field, fall behind in math, and even have anxiety in our personal lives. Social psychologist and Columbia University provost Claude Steele has just released a book called Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us. He joins us now. Provost Steele, welcome back to WNYC. Hi there.
Great to be here.
So even in the absence of overt racial stereotyping, there's the threat of stereotyping in the air, which produces real and negative outcomes. Can you give us one or two examples to start?
Yeah, I could begin with the title story of the book, Whistling Vivaldi. It comes from an episode described by Brent Staples, who is an editorialist for the New York Times, an African-American, who, when he was in graduate school at the University of Chicago, walking down the streets of Hyde Park, dressed informally as a student, he realized that his mere presence was making people uncomfortable. They'd avoid him, look away, and the light crossed the street so they wouldn't cross his path. And he began to realize at some level, not maybe fully conscious, that he was being seen as possibly a threatening African-American male. And his solution to the problem was to simply whistle Vivaldi, which he claims to be able to do very well. that act, whistling classical music, sort of punctured the stereotype that people were seeing him through. They relaxed, and then he relaxed, and he went on his way. That's a good example of stereotype threat in the sense that nobody on the street said anything to him, but he could tell from their behavior that he was being perceived stereotypically.
So that's really a response to stereotype threat. I wonder what your opinion is of that instance. Does it really solve anything? Was he whitewashing his own identity to an extent that makes you uncomfortable? What do you think about the whistling Vivaldi story?
That's an interesting reaction to that story, because, yes, I do. I think it's a great illustration of the phenomenon, and I think, as maybe I'll get a chance to explain, I think everybody experiences stereotype threat. We're all members of some group or have some identity that's negatively stereotyped, and when we're in situations where those stereotypes could be applied to us, we know we could be seen or treated stereotypically, and we often do things like whistle Vivaldi to deflect them. So I think it's something that's often done rather automatically, sometimes even unconsciously. But stereotype, you wouldn't, in an ideal world, perhaps you would not want it to be the case that a person would have to whistle Vivaldi or to display refined cultural knowledge in order to avoid being stereotyped on the streets of his own neighborhood. That's not something that you think of as desirable, but it was a strategy that he used, and I think it illustrates the poignance of this phenomenon in real life.
Listeners, call in with your own examples of how you think stereotype threat has manifested in your own experience. Do you find yourself changing your behavior to avoid falling into a negative stereotype about your race, class, gender, age, whatever, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post a comment to our show page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for Claude Steele, who has written Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us, 212-433-9692. And did you want to say something more about how we're all affected by stereotype threats?
Well, I think I got most of it out there, that I do think, you know, age, race, political persuasion, mental health status, region of the country, dialect, whether we're overweight or not overweight, all of these can be thought of as social identities, and about all of them exists negative stereotypes. And when we're in situations where those negative stereotypes could be applied to us, we can feel a certain tension about that, a certain foreboding that perhaps we're going to be in that moment reduced to that negative stereotype, seen and treated in terms of that negative stereotype.
And in a country that in a few decades is not going to have any ethnic or racial majority over 50%, nobody's going to be immune from the consequences. One of the studies that you cite, because your book is based on research, found that reminding African-American students just before a test about the negative stereotype of blacks' academic ability, that reminder caused those students to do worse on the test than they would have otherwise. You want to tell us about that experiment?
Yes, this is a study done not by me, but by a number of other social psychologists, Ryan Brown and Eric Day, and it's a clever study in that they gave IQ tests to college students, white and black, and if you don't even have to remind them of race, you just give them a test that's frustrating. And in this case, it was a nonverbal IQ test. As they experience frustration on that test, that triggers the relevance of the negative stereotype in our society that's afoot in our society about intelligence among African Americans. It's a dark side of our culture and society, but there it is. That stereotype exists, and when a person experiences frustration on such a test, maybe that stereotype is relevant. Maybe they could be confirming it, or maybe they could be seen to be confirming it, and that can be upsetting enough to undermine their performance on the test, as it did in this particular experiment.
And you found go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, but the good news is, and part of the reason that I can be confident of that interpretation is that if you give them the test on the same test, but this time you tell them it's not a test of intelligence, it's not diagnostic of their cognitive abilities, it's simply a puzzle. It has nothing to do with how smart you are. They do just as well as white students taking the test under that instruction. And the interpretation, of course, is that under that instruction, the stereotype about blacks' intelligence is not relevant to how well they're doing on a puzzle that has nothing to do with intelligence. So freed from the pressure of being stereotyped, they just relax, perform the puzzle, and do as well as everybody else.
You also found, conversely to that, I guess, that floating this negative stereotype just before the test affected the higher-achieving black students more than the others. Is that because they care more about doing well on the test, and so the pressure to defy the stereotype is even more intense?
Exactly. I think there are all forms of stereotype threat are experienced by people who care about the domain where the negative stereotype applies. So the irony of it is that for African-American students who are the most committed to doing well in school and doing well academically, it's for them that the prospect of being negatively stereotyped or confirming that stereotype is most upsetting and the most injuring to their performance. For students that don't care about doing well in school and aren't academically identified, then whether or not their stereotype isn't so important and it isn't so disruptive to their performance, they don't perform well. they don't perform well. I'm not saying that, but they're not responsive to whether to stereotype threat in this situation. It's for the group that really cares the most.
Before we get to some calls, and our board is full, as you can imagine, in our diverse New York area, many people will have many different kinds of examples of this. So we'll get to some of those callers in a minute. In the meantime, with our lines full, if you want to ask a question or post a story of how stereotype threat has affected you, even without actually being stereotyped by anybody, you can post it to our webpage, for this segment at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But here's one other interesting example that struck me from your book, even though before we go to calls. And interestingly, this is one that affected white people, and that is having white and black men play mini golf. And if you tell white men that it's about natural athletic ability, they do poorly. If you tell them it's about strategy, they do well. And yeah. It was the opposite for black men.
Yeah, that's a dramatic demonstration that Jeff Stone did at Princeton, that you have them play 10 holes of miniature golf in the laboratory, and just before they begin, now these are elite athletes, you tell them that this is a test of natural athletic ability, and then under that stereotype, the white athletes underperform, and the black athletes perform well. Presumably what's happening to the white athletes is that as they experience frustration on this task, the stereotype about whites not having natural athletic ability comes to bear. They care about doing well. They're invested athletes, and so they get distracted trying to disprove the stereotype and worrying about it, and their performance goes down. But the reverse happens when you represent exactly the same golfing task as a measure of sports strategic intelligence. Now the group that's under stereotype threat are the black athletes. They have the same pressure the white athletes just had. Their frustration could signal that they're confirming or going to be seen to confirm this negative stereotype about their group's intelligence. And under that stereotype, they underperform and white athletes do much better.
Arthur in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Arthur.
Yes, hello. This program is very interesting. I have a point to make. I would like your guest to speak about how the negative stereotyping has affected the Jewish community considering our current economic crisis. Because every time it comes up in any kind of polite conversation, they seem to shun away from their Jewishness. Thank you.
Which, by the way, was not what he told our screener he wanted to ask about. But is there an answer to that? Was he just trying to blame the Jews for the financial crisis, or do you think there's a question there relevant to your book?
Well, I do think the connection I might make is that I think all groups are, have negative stereotypes about them. And when they're in situations where that could be a way that they're perceived, people do things to deflect that unconsciously. African-American academics tell me, or a friend of mine tells me, I never get on an airplane without wearing a tie. And he said, it's not just ordinary things, but when things go wrong, having a tie helps me be perceived the right way. So people do have some sense of adjusting to themselves in ways to deflect the stereotype. And maybe the caller is referring to that. I didn't get the full meaning of what he meant, but I can't imagine, I'm not sure of what stereotype he has about he's referring to about the Jewish community, but I can see the principle in general.
Right. Well, one place where, again, I didn't understand it well enough to know whether that was just a slur against Jews or whether he was raising an observation. I wonder if if there's something legitimate there. Maybe some Jews listening are embarrassed by Bernie Madoff. I've certainly heard that among some Jewish friends. And whether that comes up, I don't know. If anybody wants to follow that up, you can call in 212-433-WNYC among Jewish listeners. Interesting from our comments page, along the lines of what you were just talking about with the going on a plane. So Yvonne on our comments page writes, "When I moved into a fancy building, I dressed really well, Gucci loafers, etc., so that I would not be mistaken for a housekeeper, because one kid thought I was a nanny."
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that is a lot of these examples have a certain poignance that stereotype threat can lead people to behave in ways that are like that they have to deflect a negative perception like that.
Marty, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a single mother with three daughters in suburbia, New Jersey, and I found that when I settled into my new town with an excellent school district, my whole objective was the school district. The taxes are there, and I'm only going to be there temporarily to get them through the school district. But I found that in this very conservative Italian community that I was unusual in that I was willing to be a single parent, pay the taxes, and my children were treated differently initially until they had, until I had proven, I'm not Italian American, but proven family style, very conservative, not only dress code, but curfews and all of that, and also within the school. I've had to be more of a strict mother and member in the community and given up my ability to work extra hours and do things to provide in order to be a stay-at-home traditional role model. And once I got into the community and committed financially, you know, into a home, that was my motivation, was to make this work. So giving up the money to be stay-at-home mom and be involved with the community has actually enhanced the children's lives, and with the teachers too. There's a more respectful thing going on there, and I just wanted to share that. It's pretty cool.
Thank you for telling the story. I guess in this case you're saying it has a positive outcome, a kind of a happy ending, but a stereotype threat that actually kept you from trying to make more money, but rather to spend more time in the home because you thought that's what the community required in order to respect you. Let's go on to another one. Chris, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I used to work in New Jersey in an upscale area, doing construction, painting and stuff like that. And my boss, who went to the job to, I guess, get the contract for the houses, was white. So then he would send us to the houses. And when we would come there, everybody would be like all tensed up because they're all looking at us. And I noticed that whenever we started speaking, and our accent came out, then everybody would be relaxed. The owners would all be like, oh, hey, what's up? You want something to drink? Where are you from? Yada, yada, yada. And then I noticed that all the time. When we come there, we kept silent. Nobody said nothing. It was like, because we're in somebody's house. Everybody was like kind of all tense and looking at you funny. But then when we start to speak, then everybody's cool. Oh, he has an accent. He's not from America. So I felt like being black and not black American was kind of more easygoing on the people we worked with in the white rich areas that we worked in. So
yeah, that's a pretty interesting one. And Professor Steele, as I'm sure you know, there have been studies that have shown that white American employers are more likely to hire Caribbean blacks than African Americans, and presumably because they're just seen as less threatening.
Yes, we have done research too in collaboration with Kay Doe here at City College and her students. We once did a study looking at stereotype threat in first generation versus second generation black immigrants. And we found a very interesting pattern that the effect I just described, for example, on test performance of black immigrants, first generation black immigrants did not show those effects. So they did not show the standard effect, if I can call it that, of black underperformance under stereotype threat on that test. However, in the second generation, they did. So there is something about the experience, and maybe as the gentleman suggested, the fact that when people hear an accent, it's a little bit like whistling Vivaldi. It signals that this particular person of African descent is not the person to whom the stereotype applies, the standard American racial stereotype applies, and that relaxes the person, and then as the gentleman described, the whole scene goes a little easier.
We'll continue in a minute with Claude Steele. He's the provost of Columbia University and the author of a new book called Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us, mostly about the concept of stereotype threat in our lives. And we have some other very interesting callers waiting to go on. Toby and Merrick, who talks about being a pathbreaker, a pioneer in certain stereotype-breaking situations. That's also referred to in the book. And we'll take it from there. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Check out our latest 10-question census quiz. It's a demography quiz, and for this round, they are all questions about the demography of New York City. It begins with the question, which borough of New York City is expected to grow the fastest in the next 10 years? And it proceeds from there. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show for our 10 questions that count demography quiz. And we have a new feature there where you can propose a quiz question for one of our future census demography quizzes. So think about something from your neighborhood, your county, or wherever. Make sure it's actually data-based and propose a quiz and a question, and maybe we'll include it in one of our future 10 questions that count census and demography quizzes. We continue with Claude Steele, author of Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us. And you start the book with the story of how you realized you were black. It was during the summer when you were a kid in Chicago, and you were only allowed to go to the local pool on Wednesdays. You want to tell that story and how it relates to your thesis?
Yes. I was asking myself, when is the first time I remember realizing I was black? And that's the episode that I think is when it happened. And I think what it illustrates is that was the first time I realized that being black came to some effect in the world, that it had circumstances that I would have to deal with tied to being black. And so I use it to illustrate the fact that that's how our social identities, for example, race, become important to us, is that we realize there are conditions we have to deal with because we have the identity. Then the identity starts to be important, and we start to think about it and sometimes worry about it and sometimes celebrate it and sometimes use it as a way to relate to other people. And it becomes a central thing in our life. If we don't have to deal with things because we've got a given feature, then it doesn't come to be very meaningful to us. So I'm just trying to sort of get in that story to the roots of identity. Where does a sense of having a particular identity come from? That's the purpose of that story.
Toby and Merrick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Toby.
Hi. I just really related to the very first story as something that I've been doing for a long time and didn't realize it. Because I'm a blonde lady, like family Swedish and everything, and I also really love math and science and physics. And I just found myself, whenever I was in a group of men, it happened recently where I met the science teachers at the high school where my husband teaches. And I got so excited. I was like, oh, I just love physics. And they just stared at me with this blank stare, like, oh, really? And then I felt like instantly, like I had to just say, oh, yeah, you know, the Large Hadron Collider, can you believe they might find the Higgs boson particle? I mean, just trying to fill in that brief second where they're like, yeah, right, with like, no, I really am.
By the way, you're going to love our next guest, Toby, who is Theo Gray. He wrote a book called The Elements, which is an unbelievably beautiful photographic walk through the periodic table that he's turned into one of the first iPad apps.
I've seen previews of that.
And yeah. I realize it's chemistry and not physics, but he's got some issues to raise, and he's also going to talk about the search for the name for the brand newly discovered element number 117. But you may want to stay tuned for that coming up in just a few minutes. But do you think that was all because you were a woman, Toby, or do you think that anybody who says they like physics is considered weird in our culture?
Well, it wasn't just the physics stuff. You know, it was other things. And it happened a lot more when I was in my early 20s. And I was really blonde, and I just moved from the South. And so I kind of had this Southern accent, and I'd start talking about, like, oh, I don't know, you know, I'm much more into Einsteinian physics and particle physics. And I mean, it's just, I don't think people were expecting that from someone like me for some reason.
Did it make you change your behavior at all?
Absolutely, yeah. I just feel like I always was just trying to get in very quickly some evidence to back up my claim. Like, I expected to not be believed.
Yes. Thank you for your call. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Doug in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Doug.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have a comment about the role of positive stereotypes, actually. Can the effect be used to enhance performance? Specifically, I'm a student at Columbia, and I have a friend who's taking the MCAT today. And last night, I kind of reminded him that he was Asian, hoping to play off this stereotype that, you know, he's good at math and science, and hoping to increase his performance. And I was wondering if that has an effect, or if stereotype, you know, you can only mediate bad stereotypes.
Dr. Steele?
Yeah, no, we addressed this question in the book. There's a lot of interesting examples. I guess the quick answer is yes. If you're in a group who's positively stereotyped in a domain, then the frustration you have in trying to perform in the domain, it doesn't become a signal that you don't belong there. And you have more resilience against a negative meaning from frustration, and so it can help you perform better. This is called sometimes stereotype lift. Then if you're benefited by a positive stereotype, it does help your performance.
That's similar to the example you gave with African Americans playing mini golf as a test.
Exactly.
Okay, so it does have a positive influence as well.
Yeah, it definitely can. It typically isn't as strong as the negative, but it's there.
Uh-huh. Doug,
I wanted to add a little something to the woman who just spoke about her experience in math.
Yeah,
what she's describing is interesting, and one aspect of it I wanted to draw out is the experience of having to deal with that over a long period of time, because that's a part of the whole stereotype threat phenomenon, is the chronicity of it, that if she goes into the math field, then she kind of has to deal with this over a long period of time, and that's when I think it can have its more serious consequences, that and maybe after a while a person can get tired of dealing with it, and it can be part of the story for why fewer women go into math and quantitatively based fields.
One of your chapters is called Reducing Identity Threat in College, in which you suggest ways that stereotypes can be diminished. I'm just relating this to Doug's question. You're ultimately hopeful that this stuff doesn't have to dictate our outcomes in life forever and ever. So how do you work to mitigate it?
Yeah, that's one of the, I would say, the last 10 years of our research in this on this problem has been how do you mitigate this? And to put it in thumbnail, there are a variety of ways, but they all kind of boil down to a person having a narrative, an understanding of the circumstance they're in that helps them understand that the cues are not so are not tied to really threatening outcomes and to really threatening possibilities. You need to have experiences which make that plausible and root that in reality, and that schools, for example, where stereotype threat can be a real impediment to minority students, to women in math and the like, or to in athletic situations, it can be an impediment to other groups. In those kind of situations, one of the requirements of them to be successful is that they develop a kind of trusting relationship between the student and the setting, that issue has to be addressed so that the student can feel like the cues that might otherwise suggest they'd be under threat because of who they are or under threat of stereotypes, as the woman was describing, that's not going to be such a big problem that she can't belong there, that she will be accepted there. That question is going to be one of the primary questions a person has in that setting, and it has to be addressed, whether it's a school classroom setting or whether it's a workplace setting. That's a part of what has to be done for us to have a truly integrated society, is one way of putting it.
Roland in D.C., you're on WNYC. Hi, Roland.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Roland, if you're on a speakerphone, would you pick up the handset? Thank you.
Okay. I'm a black guy professional who always wears a tie and jacket when I fly. And I've always done that since I was, I guess, a football player, because you get treated differently. I've also always uncomfortable if I'm in an office building late at night and I'm going on an elevator alone and a white woman gets on the elevator. I always feel uncomfortable for her, sometimes to the point of even getting off of the elevator, not wanting her to be alone riding down with me.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Wow.
And I don't know whether other people have had that experience, but my issue With respect to changing stereotypes, the night of the election, I was working with the Obama campaign in Ohio, and I flew from Columbus to Chicago. And the next morning, as I was trying to get my way back to Washington, I noticed that people looked at me differently, Europeans in particular. And I thought it was my imagination, but two students who were traveling with me, law students, said, do you know that they seem to – I look nothing like Barack Obama, and obviously I could not be him. But I wondered whether stereotypes had changed at all by someone being elevated to a level that no minority had had before. And additionally, I know when I go to China a lot, Chinese people do treat me very differently now than they did before Obama's election.
Interesting. Interesting. Dr. Steele, real quick on this because we're going to run out of time.
Yeah. No, I think the Obama election is a really profoundly important step in the right direction of reducing stereotypes. I don't think it's completely sufficient. That is, down on the ground of most of our lives, we still have a ways to go. But I think that was a transformative event. And it's interesting that the caller notes it had such a profound effect in Europe and maybe Asia. I've experienced the same thing in Europe, I'd say. So that's a profound step in the right direction. I don't think it's enough yet to fix everything, but we're on the way.
I just want to sneak in Dave in Brooklyn, even though we're a little bit over time, because he wants to respond to that unresolved question of Jews and stereotype threat around the financial crisis. Dave, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me. I just wanted to speak to that real quick. I sort of understand where that caller was coming from. I'm Jewish, and I think that when financial times get rough, particularly when it's something involving banks, there's sort of, because traditionally the stereotype against the Jewish people, when you talk to people who are, like, really serious anti-Semites, like to the point where, you know, Jews run the world, the myth of the bankers that run the world sort of just sounds like changing one of the words around but saying essentially the same thing. And I feel like, particularly when we're talking about, like, the Bernie Madoff thing, I know for a fact that I've seen a lot of, you know, you see within the Jewish community a lot of people now sort of running out to say, oh, we denounce him too, we denounce him too, which I think obviously plays off of the fear that people are really worried that, again, because when economic times are tough, the Jews are always a pretty good scapegoat for it. I've definitely seen in my own life people, you know, sort of being like, yeah, times are really rough right now, huh? And me sort of having to be like, well, yeah, for me too. And it's like, well, why do I have to insist on that? You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. David, and you get the last word. We're going to have to leave it there, but very provocative material, very thoughtful material, and helpful, as I think we heard in the last part of our conversation, with respect to specific ways that you can help mitigate stereotype threat in your lives. Claude Steele is the provost at Columbia University and now the author of Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, what do you name a brand newly discovered element? Stay with us.